Well, it's Tuesday, and here on WMUK, we preview the Chamber Music Festival of Saugatuck every week. And this week, I have on the line one of the co-directors of the festival, Drew Lee. So nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, too, Kara. Thanks for having me.
Well, Drew, you're doing double duty this week, not only helping to run the festival with Jenny Walvoord, your partner and wife. You will be at the piano this week in some great works. You call the concert Brahms and Company. Maybe you can give us a quick overview of why you gave it that title.
Well, the three composers represented in this program are not only contemporaries of Brahms, but they were his friends. Heinrich von Herzogenberg, I think I'm saying that correctly, was a friend of Brahms who actually married one of Brahms's piano students. Karl Reinecke was a friend of Brahms who was also very well known and very well regarded in his time as an educator, a performer, a pianist, a conductor. He was a very versatile musician, very influential musician. And of course, Brahms himself, one of the three B's.
Writing that wonderful trio in, is it B major?
In B major, yeah. Yes, indeed.
Yes. The Chamber Music Festival of Saugatuck, there's also an element of friendship and collegiality baked in to the festival. Would you tell us about the friends you're bringing together for this week's set of concerts?
Yes, I'd be happy to. In Saugatuck at this festival very much value friendship and collegiality, and the manifestation of that through making music together and just having a really good time doing that, taking it seriously, of course, but enjoying one another's company, going out for lunch and having coffee with one another and rehearsing together. That's very important to us. And some of the friends of ours who are performing this week include Paul Austin on horn, on French horn. He is a longtime friend of the festival. He has performed for us many, many times. Sarah Constable is a new friend of ours. We're introducing her to our audiences for the first time this year. Sarah Bast on the piano. Also, we're introducing her as a new performer this summer. My wife, Jenny Walvoord, is performing, and Alicia Eppinga is also performing on cello.
And Alicia and Jenny have been on many seasons, of course. I recognize their names. And Paul Austin. Let's talk about Paul for a little bit. He is one of the players in the Grand Rapids Symphony for his year-round job, generally, is Grand Rapids Symphony. But he's very highly regarded in horn circles internationally.
Yes, he is. He is. He's an amazing horn player. He plays so beautifully. He plays so consistently. He not only does he play well, but he has a way with words. And in Saugatuck, we always introduce our pieces and we talk about them with the audience in lieu of program notes. And the way Paul introduces his pieces, the pieces that he performs on, is just unparalleled. You have to be there to know what I'm talking about. And yes, he's just very well regarded in all circles, both on the stage and administratively. He's deeply involved in music administration and serves on many boards and committees, and he's very passionate about that. So he's very well regarded in that matter as well, in that way.
Kalamazooans may know of his ties to Kalamazoo through the wonderful bassoonist, Dr. Wendy Rose, who's on the faculty at Western, and they call themselves RAD, Rose and Austin Duo.
Yes, brilliant.
Does Paul open the concert?
Yes, he does. Yes, it's a piece called The Nocturne for horn and piano. It's opus 112, and it's about 5 or 6 minutes long, and it's just a gem of a piece. It's beautiful, it's lyrical, and it really, I think, will not only captivate our audiences on Thursday and Friday, but also surprise them, because most of them probably are not familiar with Reinecke as a composer. and they'll be wondering, where on earth have we been? We've never heard of Reinecke, yet music is so beautiful. So I'm looking forward to Paul opening the concert with that.
Let me into the world of the concert programmer, because that's one of the hats you wear as a festival director. You have a lot of say over what composers are featured and how concerts themselves are designed.
Yeah.
You are a concert pianist, but I'm sure that doesn't mean you have a full catalog in your mind of chamber works for all different combinations, right? I mean, how do you discover these things?
Well, a number of ways. I admit that I am, as a pianist, very piano-centric in my mental encyclopedia of chamber works.
Right.
And I always am delighted when I'm educated by those around me, especially my wife, Jenny, who's incredibly familiar with a much broader range of chamber music than I am, especially these little gems that seemingly most people do not know, including this Reinecke piece and this Herzogenberg trio. When we get together, when we get our brains together in the fall to plan for the next summer's season, we do a lot of listening. We go online, we go on YouTube, we listen to things we are familiar with and things we aren't familiar with. And YouTube has that wonderful autoplay feature, you know. Sometimes it's wonderful, at least. In this case, it is when we listen to something and then it presents something else similar to us. And many times we find ourselves thinking, wow, you know, we never thought of that piece. We should program that. It's a beautiful piece. It would work well in this program or that program. And so we start cooking up our programs that way. And then we also ask for input often from our friends, our performer friends, and ask for requests. And in the case of this week, Paul Austin put in the request for the Herzogenberg. And of course, we had never heard of that composer. We had never heard of this piece. And we listened to it and we thought, hey, this works really well. This would be delightful to perform and to present to the audience. And then once we get a short list, but it's usually very long of works that delight us and that appeal to us. We then try to pair them up and put them together in what we feel would be interesting programs. Interesting and logical programs. And I don't recall exactly, Kara, how we came to these three pieces, but I think it was just a moment, really, where we looked at these lists. We make a spreadsheet, like we spread out sheets, not really a spreadsheet, but we spread out sheets of paper all over our floor in our basement, and we look at them, and we're trying to put this together with that and this together with that. And then suddenly we realize, oh, you know, I wonder if these three composers, or these two composers, Reinecke and Herzogenberg, have anything to do with Brahms. And so we do a little digging and we realize, oh yeah, they actually have quite a bit to do with Brahms. And so hence we came up with the title Brahms and Company.
I have to ask you about this combination of oboe, French horn, and piano in the Herzogenberg piece. This is rare. Why don't we hear this more often?
Kara, that's a great question. we hear oboe typically paired with flute so much more commonly than with horn. I believe that the best answer to that question is that Herzogenburg was either writing for specific musicians he had in mind, and I'm guessing this. I'm not sure of this. Perhaps he had friends who one played the oboe and the other played the horn, and he knew they were getting together, and he wanted to write something for them to read through. Or maybe he was a daring composer and wanted to try a combination of instruments that was not common, that was perhaps untraditional, to see how he could exploit the different timbres of those instruments and to complement the timbres of those instruments together. In any case, I feel he succeeded quite wonderfully. The oboe contrasts so obviously with the sound of the horn, and he exploits that in this trio. And the textural layering that occurs when you pit the oboe against the horn, against the piano, it has quite a remarkable result, I feel.
Well, let's talk a little now about your perspective of this work by Brahms, the Opus 8. The history of the piece, first of all, is pretty interesting because, you know, you have this very low opus number, but it turns out Brahms couldn't quite let it go at that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. From what I understand, I admittedly have never studied the original version of this trio. I may have heard it in my youth, and now that I'm turning 40 this year, my memory, especially having raised kids in the last seven of those 40 years, it's gone pretty murky, I have to admit. from what I understand, the revised version is quite, it's shorter, it's a little bit less effusive than emotionally effusive than the original version. There's almost adolescent lack of restraint, I feel, in the original version, which I think always bothered him. And he wanted to refine his expression more and I think he was 55 when he decided to publish the revised version. And he was 20 when he wrote the original version. So many, many years have gone by. And I think back when I was 20, I'm 40 now. I will be 40 in very shortly, actually. And I think, you know, I have changed so much. Life has changed me in many, many ways in 20 years. The way I listen to music, the way I play music, the way I feel about music. And I can only imagine that the same was true for Brahms. And the piece bears, yes, an early opus number, it's Opus 8, but it has the hallmarks. The revised version has, of course, the hallmarks, as you would expect from a composer who has aged significantly since the first version of this piece. The hallmarks of what one has come as a seasoned listener to expect of Brahms, the epic scope, both architecturally and emotionally, of the piece, the depth of the lyricism, it was all there when he was 20, and I think what he just did was took that diamond and polished it even further because he knew how to, at the age of 55, he knew how to polish it even more and make it even more beautiful and more concise and more impactful. And so the remarkable thing here is that I don't know if I've mentioned this yet, but Brahms kept the original version, and this is a composer who was he was readily burning the works of his that were not up to his level of satisfaction. He had a very high standard for himself and was incredibly self-critical. Yet he kept the original version. He did not expel it from his output. And why he did this with this piece, I don't know. And I believe this is the only work in which in his entire output that has both versions, both endorsed by the composer, the early version and the late version. And I find that very fascinating. As an artist, I perform sometimes works that I have performed before, and I usually find myself thinking, this is better than it was before. I've matured, I've grown technically, I've grown musically, I've grown emotionally, and this is better. I would hate to have anybody hear me the way I was 10 years ago with these pieces, whatever they may be. But yet Brahms chose to keep that for himself, for us, and I think that gives us incredible insight into his creative process and the depth of the maturing, I should say, of his musicality as he aged.
Well, it's been great catching up with you, Drew. I'm not quite through yet because we didn't start off by talking about the current season, and I'm just curious about the concerts I've missed. There was Tesla, and there was this 4, 5, and 6, the oboe-centric concerts, and more. So how does season 31 feel to you so far?
Season 31 feels great. we did not realize, Jenny and myself, we did not realize until opening night, Thursday night, when Tesla played 2 weeks ago, that this season marks our 10th year doing playing the roles of artistic directors of this festival. They've flown by completely. And this is something we look forward to every year so much. I look forward to this so much every year, not only getting to perform with friends, but also finding ways to get friends to perform with one another, even if it's not with me. I delight in that. And I feel that this season, the 31st season, we've succeeded in finding ways to continue doing that, essentially.
Another aspect of the festival is the crowds that attend. We've talked before in years past about both the vocal enthusiasm of the crowds and the sort of enduring year after year nature of many people who return for this festival. Just checking in to see that the special nature of the crowds are still there.
They're still lit, as as my younger students would say, Kara. They're still lit. They're still absolutely, as far as I can tell, passionate about and excited for this festival. We've been told so many times in the last couple of weeks that this is the official beginning of their summer, and that the music making that we present in this festival is such an integral part of what makes our audience's summer their summer. And we're just absolutely honored to be able to play the role of the people who help make this happen. It's not just us, of course. It's our board, it's our volunteers, it's our interns. It takes a village. And We just love our audience. We feel like they're our family. And in fact, I when I talk to them when Jenny and myself, we introduce our concerts, I always refer to them as our family, and I welcome newcomers to our family. We still, of course, serve coffee and cookies at intermission, and wine and a wonderfully varied dessert reception after every concert. And it helps to encourage people to mingle, to talk to one another, to get to know one another, to get to know the performers, to get to know us, you know, Jenny and myself, and get to know our board. And it's not just the music. It's the experience that makes Saugatuck, I think, unique and special. And we delight in that. And as I say, we're very honored to be a part of that experience.
Well, saugatuckmusic.org is the place to find out all the details on this week's concerts and the rest of the season. Ticket information is there. And Drew, have a great week of concerts, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival as well.
Oh, I will, undoubtedly. Thank you, and hope to see you soon, Kara.